We'll call the Conference Committee on House File 5 to order for March 12th. Just a couple of housekeeping items. I did get a memo from Senate folks who run the electronics, and these microphones are not meant to be twisted out of the way and push and pulled back and forth. It wrecks the electronics behind them. And then people, you can do it once to get it back in front of you, but it wrecks the electronics underneath them, and then the tape is destroyed, and it isn't able to pick up the words, and the public isn't able to pick up the words, and there is a great deal of interest in the words that we say here today. So if people could just not swing the microphones away from them. Just a housekeeping, also what we're hoping to accomplish today. I think we had a pretty good walk through of the side-by-sides last night, have a pretty decent idea. Representative Atkins and I did meet last night to just go over the side-by-side a little bit more. Both of us each went through nine committees. I know I did. You went through nine committees. And so there was a really extensive process in both bodies, and we just wanted to understand more about how the House wound up where they wound up and how the Senate wound up where we wound up and have a decent conversation. We thought that'd be helpful to the process, and I think that we had staff there that should be very helpful in bringing some ideas to bring back to the committee that we could probably be ready to work through some of that this evening. We have this room until 11:45, at which time we have to vacate and allow for the judiciary to come in. They've got some pretty big bills up today. You might have heard on the radio this morning or TV as well. And at 11:45, we are planning to recess to the call of the chair. We expect to be back in this room this evening to work through some of these issues. The House has a committee at 4 o'clock that with, 30 bills or something to go through, Joe says. He said 8. We're pushing him. He's maybe saying 7:30 now. We're going to push him as close as we can to earlier in the evening rather than later. But we will recess at 11:45 to the call of the chair, hoping to get back here by no later than 7:30, earlier if possible. So stay tuned. We will let you know as soon as we can. In our conversations, I think there's a couple of open items that are going to take some work of the committee to get through. And I think the lion's share of the bill, understanding where the House came from and where the Senate came from, we can probably work out some of the differences. We highlighted some of them on our walkthrough yesterday. But the three that are really going to require some attention are rulemaking, the funding mechanism, and the active selector. And I thought that a very, Joe and I thought a very good way to use this morning would be to just hear from broader conversation of the members, kind of where we're at on those three provisions. Rulemaking, the House has, a 30-day expedited rulemaking that is in effect immediately and continues forward. The House has a similar rulemaking, 21 days, incredibly expedited, but then goes to, after the first year of operations, it goes to the expedited rulemaking process that's provided for in Chapter 14, which is typically a six-month process to get rules through. The funding, I think everybody's pretty aware of. The Senate uses the health impact fee, the tobacco tax, and the House still has the provision of withhold as the bill was introduced with, and active selector, I think, also has gotten enough attention that I don't need to go over that. With those introductory remarks, I don't know, Joe, would you like to add anything to this discussion to get it kicked off? Another issue that we probably should work on this morning is we had a talk about EMCHA, and I think Kirby was going to be here to help us step through exactly where we're at on that, because we did get final rules from the feds. We mentioned that last night in the hearing, that the final rules did indicate that we cannot count on being able to gain access to the federal reinsurance pools to support our EMCHA operations, and we will have to have some other plans, and in the bill that we have before us, it calls for Commerce in consultation with MCHA to plan for a structured wind-up of that, you know, historic valuable program. So we might spend some time digging into that and what that might look like and give people some indication of that. So with that, if members have comments regarding the three rulemaking, funding, active selector, happy to entertain those at this point.
Mr. Chair.
The Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The only thing that I would add to that is that as we did a little walkthrough both here among the group and then afterwards, and we went through it in a little more detail, it was pretty impressive. In spite of nine different committees and all of the changes that get made, the level of fundamental agreement on so many issues, that was nice to see. And it's still a nightmarish kind of thing for the staff folks that actually have to blend the two, but it was, I thought, a very positive effort. And then kind of narrowing the discussion to some of the sort of the fundamental differences that we have. But there was, the folks from MCHA here this morning? We talked last night about ideally having them here this morning to visit about some questions that we had relative to MCHA. But maybe, Mr. Chairman, if you could, the financing, obviously there's a significant difference in the financing between, you know, we've got the premium withhold, you guys raid the general fund. But could you provide the underlying reasoning behind the use of the tobacco tax and the general fund dollars to fund this? I mean, what went through the House was the talk that those who benefit from it would be the ones that pay for it.
Yep.
And that was kind of, I think, committee after committee. And there was, you know, some concerns. I think, in fairness, the carriers were concerned about the additional cost that they would spread then among all premium payers. But what we kind of liked was the fact that there was a nexus between who pays the fee and who benefits from it. Can you kind of give us some sense of what the thought?
Yeah, I mean, financing tool some is? Of the thoughts behind the Senate's position to utilize the funding mechanism of the health impact fee were that it is just a reality of implementation of the Affordable Care Act that there are premium effects in the particularly in the individual market. And the Senate was very concerned about these and wanted to do what we could to ensure that we did not exacerbate the premium effects that occur because of guaranteed issue, no annual limits, no pre-existing conditions. Eventual termination of MCHA, all of these things have premium effects, and to increase the premiums on the individual market. There certainly are offsets to that, and I've spoken about those many times. We have the Department of Health study that indicates that we will likely receive somewhere in the ballpark of $150 million a year in reductions to uncompensated care costs, which it's been argued, and I think correctly, for many years, uncompensated care costs wind up as a direct dollar-for-dollar increase on insurance premiums for the fully insured market. So to the extent that we can reduce the uncompensated care costs, we should get that same dollar-for-dollar decrease on the fully insured market. There's also the ability to, as we work on bringing the MCHA population into good products on the exchange and truthfully doing it at a better rate for them because they cannot be rated on their pre-existing conditions either. MCHA does call for these populations to pay 125% of what they otherwise would pay if not for the rating because of their health issues. That is a savings to the businesses of in the ballpark of $150 million as well, but still there remains premium effects as a result of the Affordable Care Act, and we in the Senate felt it important to not exacerbate that dynamic, and that's why we wound up with utilizing the Healthcare Access Fund to fund the exchange rather than calling for that premium withhold. And I know that there are many arguments both in, you know, in favor of the withhold. I see many here who have argued for that as well, and that's a little bit of the background of where the Senate, why the Senate wound up where we did.
Can I, Mr. Chairman, if I might, can I confirm? I've just heard that it leaves a hole in the general fund, and I kind of made light of it, but I've never had it actually confirmed by staff folks or by you. Is that actually the impact?
Well, I mean, the
to use the tobacco money that would otherwise
to use the health impact fee is general fund spending. And, you know, if you spend general fund on something, you can't spend it on something else. Right. I mean, and that's the whole concept of what a hole in the general fund is additional spending on the general fund that has not yet been paid for. And so there would be some work in our committees to make sure that that was accounted for. And, you know, this was added in the Senate Tax Committee, the very committee where that the lion's share of that work to make sure that the general fund were up to the task of making sure that, that there were sufficient funds to cover the exchange and meet other high-priority items. We had that commitment from them.
And I just, when I read the language, I assumed that that was the traditional use of the tobacco money that would otherwise be used for general fund. But I didn't read it close enough to realize if you had added something on or done anything different that wouldn't otherwise leave a hole in the general fund.
Maybe I can take this opportunity to describe, because we did have a pretty long conversation about it, how the health impact fee is works mechanically. It's collected as a tax on cigarettes. It generates in the ballpark of $200 million a year. And under Governor Pawlenty's structure, the way this would work is that first the commissioner of the Department of Human Services would certify the Medicaid expenditures, the state Medicaid expenditures, so just the state share, that were attributable to tobacco use broadly in society. And that amount exceeds and always has exceeded the amount collected under the health impact fee. The first step is to transfer amounts from the health impact fund to the general fund to offset that calculation of costs attributable to tobacco use. So because that's step one, and it's never exceeded, the collections have never exceeded the costs attributable to tobacco use. The bottom line is the entirety of the health impact fund every year is transferred to the general fund. And so the health impact fund always has a zero balance. It is always transferred to the general fund. That's how it's always been. Unless we did something to change that this year, there's no expectations that would change. There is a step two if we ever had tobacco taxes that exceeded the general fund costs attributable to tobacco use, and that would transfer funds to the Healthcare Access Fund for the Minnesota care population. And those costs attributable to tobacco use. But again, we've never made it to step two. So mechanically, that's what's behind it. It is essentially, and we've never, you know, tried to hide the ball on it, it is essentially a general fund expenditure. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just a couple of comments. And I, you know, we have 2 days, it seems like. That's a schedule that's more compressed than I would have chosen. I would have worked till Monday, I think.
I would have chosen.
Not every day, but just had time for dialogue and positions to evolve and people to weigh in at various times. But at the end of the day, I don't think we're going to go home with general fund money. Even though in the connector in Massachusetts, they raised $36 million of their budget in 2012. And $25 million came from the general fund, and 6.9% or $6.9 million came from the surcharge. They had kind of a hybrid bit. And even the SEIU, one of the fellow there, Celia Wisklow, said it's a good thing to spend that kind of money out of the general fund because it's a strong good. And I think if we could find the money, that would be a good place to get it, so it's broadly based. I'm challenged by the 3.5%. funding stream. So I like the fact that it's a broad-based, non-3.5% tax thing or fee or whatever you want to call it. But I don't think that's tenable at the end. I think that you're going to be pretty starving for general fund money. The governor just abandoned a good deal of his tax increase, and there's a lot of demands that are going to be pressing against that $30 million, which I don't think it holds up at the end, which could be tomorrow. The governor might say, oh, we're not doing general fund money, and that's the inkling that I got from him when we were chatting. But I want to point out that we might need to find a third way, but in terms of the three, which I'm trying to think of some ideas. But somebody said that 3.5% in the exchange, those who benefit pay. Well, actually, those who don't benefit pay as well, because that's going to be spread out amongst the whole market. And the small group market, individual market, is besieged by new taxes under the ACA compared to the ERISA market, which is left almost harmless, just a percent or so. And so the outside the market world is going to wind up paying on probably an equal level as they spread out costs against over their pool and over their networks that are in and out of the exchange. But there's another downside to that 3.5%, which I think is really important that we need to address besides just going forward with it. UCARE, which I think is one of our most mission-oriented plans, has no outside market to spread it against. So it would all be put against those folks, against their enrollees in this market. And I think that if you'd ever talk to them, they're all about mission. And the other plans are fine, too, but this is one that stands out, I think. They were their first group to come forward with $30 million, and they didn't have to. They embarrassed everybody about what they're making. But that's kind of how they're wired. And to not let them be a part of this pool, I think, is going to be a problem. So those are my comments on both, and I've got some ideas I'm working on. I kind of talked about some of those at the Health Finance Abler, Committee.
What is it you are arguing in favor of? I mean, we're going to have a vote in front of us eventually. I'm unclear. You argued against both. We need to fund the exchange.
That's the beauty of my position, Mr. Chair.
Hey, we can plug you.
I'm actually working on an alternative.
Any other comments from members?
Mr. Chair, I'm working on an alternative that if I can get it to sell, I will bring it forward.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, you mentioned the uncompensated care reduction. I can't remember the exact number you had.
150, I'm using. It was 130 million, something to 160 something.
The trouble with using general fund, a relatively minor part of that 160 million uncompensated care is going to show up in reduced medical assistance payments. Most of it's going to end up in the regular insurance market. And I don't personally have any problem with having the full cost of operating the exchange paid for by the people who buy their health insurance through the exchange.
Okay. Mr. Chairman. Representative Atkins.
Relative to that uncompensated care, if I can probe a little bit on that, where do those we saw from the report that the savings were anywhere, and as you said, $150 million, I think, is a good ballpark. Who actually saves that money?
The uncompensated care costs, again, this goes to the argument that's been around this place for a long time that I believe is a very strong argument that when providers incur these uncompensated care costs and, have to swallow them, they don't really swallow them. They need to cover those costs in some manner in order to be a viable business. Where do they go? They have to deal with insurance companies to get paid and meet their costs. And so that's the mechanism by which the transfer occurs to raise the premium costs in the fully insured market to pay for the uninsured that show up with no manner to pay for themselves. And I believe that's I've always accepted that argument and felt that it was a very strong one, that uncompensated care costs at the end of the day are borne by the fully insured market. That's where the insurers come and negotiate with the providers that otherwise would swallow these costs, and the providers are going to need to get their costs from somewhere, and that's the mechanism by which those monies are eventually retained. So it is it's borne by those of us in society who are able to have insurance on the fully insured market.
And that was quite, you know, honestly, that was sort of my common sense assumption. But is that an accepted understanding? I mean, if you ask every carrier in the room, will they say, yeah, we're eventually it all gets passed along to us and to our customers in the form of higher premiums? Looking around the room, is there anybody that would object to what Tony just said in terms of those uncompensated? And the reason I'm pitching on this a little bit is because if there is that kind of savings, and that eventually ends up with the carriers and the customers of the carriers, then it actually kind of makes an argument out for the premium withhold. If, in fact, those are also, if you accept what the carriers have said, that those costs would be passed among or spread among consumers, the savings on the uncompensated care side, which are triple what the premium withhold would result in, which is about $56 million a year, the savings should more than make up for the premium withhold additional cost. Is that fair to say?
Representative Atkins, the withhold, the savings from uncompensated care would more than make up for the withhold, but not for the balance of the premium effects of the Affordable Care Act broadly. And also the other point about the Affordable Care Act premium effects that's very critical to mention always is that for 70% of the individual market, they will be receiving federal tax subsidies and cost-sharing reductions that at least offset those so that it's neutral or result in a significant cost saving, such that over the entirety of the individual market where most of these premium effects occur, it's actually nets to a 34% reduction in health care insurance premiums. But still there is that issue of premium effects. And so if you isolate just the withhold, yes, uncompensated care would more than cover that, but there are other effects as well. Senator Hayden?
I was just kind of trying to walk through this a little bit. So we are going to enroll our Medicaid participants, or we anticipate enrolling our Medicaid participants into the exchange. Is that right?
No? The exchange will be the mechanism by which Medicaid enrollees get enrolled.
So when the federal government is covering their cost, right?
The federal government will be covering the cost of the expansion population, and they will cover the historic 50% share of the population that has always been covered by Medicaid and will continue to be covered by Medicaid. So it's not – we're not going to 100% on everybody
on
Medicaid.
Right, right. 50% of the historic folks up to 75 and then
– I misspoke a little bit. They're going to do their initial eligibility screening through the exchange. Some of them will need to go to the counties still. The counties will still have a role. The individual, the initial individual eligibility screening largely will be done through the exchange. But Anyway, just a minor clarification.
So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is if I start following the dollars with that crowd, where who is paying, if we're talking about I'm just trying to figure out for that group of folks who pays for them. How does that work with the if we went with the 3.5 premium tax.
The 3.5 premium tax would be on policies sold through the exchange, so it would not be collected on the Medicaid population that's using the exchange to determine eligibility.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. That's what I was trying to say.
Okay. Good.
Can we ask Lynn also?
As I made the, Mr. Chairman, if I might, I asked if there were folks in the room that had a different understanding among the in terms of where the savings go from the uncompensated care savings versus where the premium withhold.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lynn Nelson from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. And just a clarification on that question you had on uncompensated care, it would really be spread out across the entire market, across the fully insured and self-insured market, because we don't contract with providers based on a fully insured market or a self-insured market. We based on providers across our entire book of business. So it would be spread across our entire book of business.
Okay.
Can I just a quick, let me know. You have a sense of that $150 million, if we use that figure, is that savings from the uncompensated cost, is that spread across your entire, that's what you're saying, is that savings would be spread across your entire book of business?
Excuse me. That's correct. Across our market share, we would spread that.
Fully insured and self-insured. So it would, everybody.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
The large businesses and the small businesses and the individuals and the entire group. Yes, you're correct.
And it's more of a cost shift that's coming from providers in the way they bill to the fully insured and self-insured market. But it would be spread across that whole market because that's how we contract with the providers.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Abler?
Well, Mr. Chair, to that point, and a lot of the cost shift, there is no chance to cost shift. On all my stuff, I'm on a fee schedule. So they tell me what my fee schedule is. I have no way to cost shift from Medicaid to the commercial market, which has actually been more constrained. Only the biggest players can negotiate. And so the uncompensated care actually comes out of the workers because the provider has less money to pay his staff and often cannot provide benefits to the staff to the extent they want. And so when the squeezes come at the Alinas and with the nurses' issues and all those arguments, the available money that's there includes uncompensated care. And so it actually comes out in many cases, in the bigger plans, out of the staff. And on the smaller groups, out of profits or ability to have more staff or better paid staff. And just Representative Hayden's, or excuse me, it was a compliment, to Senator Hayden's question. Just the $12 million of the expenses that cover the Medicaid population are being paid for by the feds in the exchange. So the costs that they incur there are compensated by the feds. So, Mr. Chair, it's not just the businesses that bear the cost and the benefits. And the if there's some way to make the 3.5% go against what is being gained by the hospitals with more business, you know, and focus it there, that'd be kind of cool. That's not part of what I'm trying to come up with, but that would be the Solomon way if there's some way to capture that.
Senator Sharon.
I understand the point of the conversation to try to do some Representative Atkins in terms of whether or not we can justify the 3.5% premium withhold or tax or whatever we're calling it against the savings that might occur on policies because of a broader distribution, a reduction in a broader distribution of uncompensated care, which, by the way, when they're negotiated for premium, the bigger you are, the better negotiations you have, the smaller, the higher. And if you're rural, there's also significant difference in the rates that are charged for these plans. So it's a very unequal distribution of how uncompensated care is covered. Even if you say it eventually trickles down to the worker, even at that level, it's very irregular throughout the state. So I understand what you're trying to get at there in terms of justifying that position. But I think that it really does something that I have trouble with on a principle level, and that is that it creates winners and losers in terms of who even within the exchange, as to who's going to pay for the exchange. Because as Senator Hayden is talking about, you know, the public program, the people who are going to go on to figure, it's one of the benefits of the exchange is that the government has given us money to put together all this technology and we can use it to really have a integrated and, at least from the consumer side, a one-stop shop kind of look and practice to get in and to know what programs they're eligible for, what credits they're eligible for. But it's not paid for, if you do it through the premium tax, it's not paid for in a broad base component. We miss the self-insured. We miss the who are going to get some of the benefits, you know, from the distribution of uncompensated care, broader and reduction, and the public programs are not. Although the federal government is making some contribution to that, so if you put it in a different form that has a broader contribution to it to support the exchange, since really there is a broad benefit, that's what the Senate has been talking about, is how to make it a broader contribution to paying for a significant
project. Can I, Mr. Chairman and Senator Sharon, I'm not necessarily asking you to answer this question. I'm just trying to recall what the public program contribution was, and maybe it's for Ms. Todd-Malmlov, the in terms of who's paying for this. And it's, I remember there's a portion of the bill, Mr. Chairman, that had that they were going to contribute towards it. I just don't remember the specifics of that there was, and maybe I'm not phrasing it correctly, but I thought they were, some of the cost of this was being charged back to those.
Talking about the Medicaid administrative costs?
Yes.
It's about 20% of the total costs are Medicaid administrative costs. That kind of goes to Senator Hayden's point that, you know, there are Medicaid costs that are picked up by the exchange. It's, you know, in 2016 where we go and the ballpark figure is $50 million, about $10 million of that is actually Medicaid allocable costs for the functions that are supporting Medicaid eligibility and functions that are able to be allocated through the cost allocation plan to Medicaid expenditures and share in federal receipts. So is that the question you're trying to get at?
That was what I was trying to recall. And, Mr. Chairman, if I might, I was under the understanding that the MCHA folks are going to be here by 10:30. Are they? Ms. Breitensure, I see, is here. I just had some, and I hopefully gave enough forewarning last night about some questions that I had relative to MCHA that she'll be able to respond. Is it? I don't want to stymie the discussion of the, but I think we've got sense of.
Representative Atkins, I said at the beginning we were hoping to hear from MCHA and the Department of Commerce. I see Mr. Brickwoody here as well. Maybe you can update us a little bit, since we did get the final rules from the feds, as to what the plan might be.
Sure. Mr. Chair, how would you like to proceed with a little discussion of the final reinsurance rule?
Maybe a description of what the final insurance rule is, just to get the public engaged, and then I'd like to find out what the current thinking is about the best approach for that.
Sure. Mr. Chair, the final reinsurance rule, which came down from Washington, was the same as the proposed rule. The effect of that is that high-risk pools are not eligible for reinsurance funds. Minnesota, a number of parties from Minnesota, including the administration, gave comment on the proposed rule in opposition to that. As folks know, Minnesota has one of the nation's largest high-risk pools. And so what the net effect of that is that we'll be paying in money into the reinsurance pool without necessarily getting those same dollars back. I think the original thinking was, at least in Minnesota, prior to the proposed rule, was that states would receive money back in proportion to what they pay in, and that appears not to be the case. And so that, I think, is the update on that. I'll turn it over to Ms. Breitner to perhaps talk about the.
Mr. Chair, just to the first point.
Representative Abler?
Can you just give us some rationale why that makes any sense?
wait a minute. You're asking for the federal rules make sense?
Well, it just seems
that's
stupid.
That's
and
a tall order.
Right?
I don't know. Mr. Brickwoody, are you up to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I would not presume to speak on behalf of the federal government. That was the rule that came down.
Oh. Can't make it up, Mr. Chair.
As I mentioned, Representative Abler, we did write in opposition very strongly to that proposed rule, but those concerns went unheeded.
Mr. Chairman, if I...
Senator Laurie, I apologize. I do have a bat call out for the executive director of MCHA, Kirby Erickson, and I think he is in a meeting with the writing carrier. I have the transition plan that MCHA developed in front of me now. We have furnished that with the governor's office. We've also shared that with the Department of Commerce. So we don't
Ms.
have
Brittinger,
any.
Is that the one that was done prior to the federal guidance that indicated that this might?
Yes.
So it
yes.
hasn't been updated to this point? Okay.
No, Mr. Chair, it hasn't. The transition plan we developed, we started back in the fall because we did not know anything about the reinsurance. We didn't know if the exchange
right.
bill would be progressing. We didn't know what role we had. In a vacuum, I would say, perhaps, we developed that because MCHA was not engaged heavily in the work groups of the exchange over the summer or the fall. So we developed a three-year plan. I have it in front of me, and I think I can furnish it to the committee if you have questions. Post-session, we've been approached by a lot of groups that are concerned about people that are covered currently by MCHA. So we have been working all session long to develop comfort language. And I guess the latest news I would have is that we had our quarterly board meeting last week, and it was a very lively discussion. The MCHA board is disappointed in the regulations that came down from the federal government.
As we all are.
We are extremely concerned about the people we represent. They're very vulnerable. They always have been. And so we've asked the Commissioner of Commerce to convene a stakeholder group. And so that was proposed and passed by the board. And I don't have any detail on it, but we are certainly open to any concerns or questions. And we'll be working with the Commissioner, I think, immediately. I think we actually have a meeting scheduled this week.
We do.
So that's with Commissioner Rothman, Peter Brickwood, Commissioner Van de Hey.
And, Mr. Chair, I would add the Commerce Department has been thinking in very similar terms since even before we got the proposed rule. A major component of what will be happening in Minnesota once guaranteed issue comes online is what will happen to the MCHA program. It's a program that served Minnesota well, and there are 26,000 individuals who are enrolled in the program. And as MCHA unwinds over a certain period of time, what happens to those individuals who are receiving coverage now is foremost in our minds. So the Commerce Department has been already engaged with, I think, the same community of stakeholders quite vigorously. I would add that while I am certainly aware that there are differences between the House and Senate language, I think the essence of the concept that's contained in this conference report is, or that will be here between the House and Senate, is essentially that not presupposing what date certain MCHA will terminate, but just rather that when we arrive at that time in the future, that the Commerce Commissioner will be the one to make sure that we have that final determination, which we think is appropriate. So we'd be supportive of that. So,
and Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think and I expect that I speak for everybody that's on this conference committee, and probably every legislator would agree on this one point at least, and that is we don't want to leave anybody behind. We want this to be a smooth transition from MCHA to the exchange, period.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkins on the Commerce Department would wholeheartedly agree with that.
And, Mr. Chairman, then in follow-up, having said that, you have, I believe, somewhere in the neighborhood of about a $34 million reserve. And I'm curious, the MCHA, not you personally, Mr. Brickwaiting, but...
if only, Mr. Chairman.
It has a nice house.
You wouldn't be sitting here with us this morning. where does that reserve go, Ms. Breitinger or Mr. Brickwaiting, at the end? When this wraps up, there will still be a reserve, unless things go right dramatically spin out of control. I assume... Perhaps some of that is used to aid the transition from MCHA for those folks into the exchange. But where does the balance go?
Ms. Breitinger?
Representative Atkins, committee members, I can tell you the amount of reserves we have has not been discussed in a board meeting or in any of our public policy committee meetings. So we are open to suggestions from the committee about what to do with those reserves. I think because there are a lot of...
Wait, he wants what? He was...
Of course he does. But I think because there's a lot of balls in the air right now, we don't know how the exchange is even going to be paid for. So we don't know. I mean, the legislature, we serve at the blessing of the legislature. I've represented MCHR for 18 years. And until the conference committee closes up, frankly, we really won't know what our fate is exactly. There's going to be a balancing act, obviously. I think what money is left over and how it's applied is just one of the many questions. But I can tell you we've had no public discussions at our board meeting, and well, sounds like we need to.
Mr. Chairman, I'll have a public discussion. My one comment would be is that reserve is designed to protect those people that are in MCHA,
yes.
And it should follow those people who are moving into the exchange. And if we can, I'm speaking from, this isn't a House position, or I just realized that as we started going through the language that there's going to be that reserve, and it's designed for those very people, to protect those folks. And if they're all moving, and, you know, part of this is to protect and make sure that transition is a smooth one, that seems to me an appropriate place to. And before anybody else starts grabbing your reserve and putting it to other purposes, I think having it follow the people that it was designed to protect only makes sense.
Anyway. Yeah, and Mr. Berkeley. Chair, Representative Atkins' point well taken. I would concur with Ms. Breitner that we do not, to my knowledge, have not had a public conversation about that, but I think you've identified one of what is a number of very serious issues that needs to be examined by the Commerce Department, MCHA, and the stakeholder community as we figure out what the most appropriate pathway is for those individuals on MCHA out of that program as it unwinds.
No, pretty soon. Orders again, you know. Yeah. Mr. Chair, but I just...
Senator Metzen.
Representative Abler, does this mean we're $30 million closer to our funding source?
Oh. Now, at best, that on a one-time basis. Is it Representative Abler?
It's a good time to be creative.
Chairman, we're trying to be very creative, yeah, so we're finding bits and pieces here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
And I agree with Representative Atkins about that it's designed to help the people who need it. And the groups you mentioned last night that are concerned about, we didn't get into much detail, but there's lifetime limits that are disposed of, but not annual limits. And issues about cumulative care over a year, which I do not believe are addressed by the ACA in the case of the dialysis autism and the AIDS folks. And probably hemophiliacs. I ran into a person who spent $1 million last year, a little kid, on stuff, on whatever. He's taken two a day, and, like, each one costs $14,000. Anyway, and so just in terms of the disposition of it, and I have a question after this, but, you know, maybe as we look at this, if there's something left over, it was paid for by the small businesses. That's who generated it. And so at the end of the day, it shouldn't go to the plans, but it would be passed through, in my opinion, to the very payers of it, if it's done. And maybe Senator Metzen has another purpose for it. But I have to bring that up. But to the witnesses, in the House position, there's language about that the limit of the assessment would be limited to 25 and 50, et cetera, percent of the MCHA. Do you have any kind of idea how that phase out is going to be and what kind of money we're talking about as the one? It's 1%, I think, that as it phases out.
Ms. Brittinger, Mr. Brickwoody?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, I know that language is in the House provision,
let me say
but could you
one
point
thing.
Us to the
I do
language.
Believe the ACA actually got rid of annual limits as well as lifetime limits. That's my understanding.
Is that right?
Yes.
That's well, the case.
Mr. Chair, why are they worried then about – I mean, I'm here to learn, too.
Why'd they worry about –
Well, why are the aides and the people that have these high-cost
well,
cases
Well, for instance, one worried. Of the things that was – one of the early scenarios that was scaring people with end-stage renal disease was there was a statement made that gained some traction around this place, you know how they can sometimes, that said that there was only, I think they said, 60 days of kidney dialysis available on the essential health benefit set. I took that very seriously. And there are, you know, there are specialty populations that have special needs that are served through MCHA. We did dig behind the kidney dialysis specifically and did determine definitively, and we have somebody from the Department of Human Services who actually did that work, that there is no such 60-day limit on kidney dialysis for that population. But there's AIDS populations that, you know, I mean, it's more about an essential health benefit set and what may or may not be covered as a covered benefit, but there as far as covered benefits, there is an annual limit is gone away, and the lifetime limits are gone away, are taken care of as well by the Affordable Care Act. And so that was an important clarification. And with that, maybe I'd
– Thank you.
Well, it looks like they've used the time well to research the answer to your question rather than
– Final Jeopardy. Yeah.
Well done. So you're welcome.
Mr. Chair, we certainly appreciate the time that you've given. So, Representative Abler, I think you're referring to on page R9 of the House language, the operations funding there, that there's a cap. Is that
– Right. Okay.
And I'm sorry, your question again was then, do we have a position on that?
No, Mr. Chair, my if I may – My question is, how much money is that? And you have a plan. I mean, you have this sketchy plan that you built in a cave without any news, and now you have some news, and I know it's all preliminary, but at some point, some of the people are going to roll into – the MSHA people, you can put some of those people in the exchange tomorrow because they're going to be very well cared for. They're only there because they're excluded from some – they couldn't be covered. Now that's all gone. Some people are the 7,000 or something are the more challenged. So you got 20,000 people or better who can roll in tomorrow. So you don't need the assessment anymore for them, probably. And so the Huntley Amendment was that the limit would be a certain number. And so I'm just curious what that number is. And trying to find new money streams and capturing the MSHA thing would be – that's what I'm getting at. So I'm curious how much money that is.
Yep.
And so that's
– Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, I don't have exact figures for you. I can check back with the office and follow up with you in terms of specific numbers. In terms of plans going forward – as you know, the Commerce Department approves the MSHA assessment on a yearly basis. And so to the extent that there are changes, I think, in the size of the population, that would inherently change the assessment going forward under current law. And I think you articulate a point that will be of significant discussion as MSHA unwinds over whatever period of time, particularly if there are specific population groups that have high costs that are sort of the last folks out the door, if you will, that could have a serious effect on both the assessment and also premiums for those individuals. And so that's certainly something that we are engaged on at the moment. I think we have a specific plan to give you at this moment, but it is something that is high on the radar screen.
Mr. Chair, just one more question.
Representative,
so what's the total MSHA assessment now annually?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, I don't recall it off the top of my head, but I'm sure I can retrieve it for you in a matter of minutes.
Is it 100 million?
You know that, don't you? I mean, isn't it in the ballpark of – it's a 3%.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I think it's in the about 168 million.
Yeah,
I can get the exact figure
well.
For you shortly.
Projected. Thank you.
Mr.
Chairman. Representative Atkins.
And I appreciate the background on MSHA. I did want to probe, I guess, a little bit on your active selector. You guys have a full-blown active selector, and I won't define that because I'm guessing everybody that's in this room is probably already. But my concern that I've expressed in the committee process is, if the carriers don't have some level of guarantee that they can get products in at the outset, will they build the necessary IT infrastructure to remain connected, to connect in the first place and then remain connected? I guess my question is, with the active selector language, first off, when does yours go into effect? How do you guarantee that carriers are going to want in? And that particularly the more modest size, not the giants, the big three, but the number 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 of the 11 here in Minnesota.
Well, honestly, I mean, I think one of the main guarantees that carriers will be well incentivized to come in and offer products for sale on the exchange is really the fact that we have very generous federal tax subsidies and cost-sharing reductions available to this low-income working Minnesotan population that make these individuals that have had a hard time finding insurance in the past and have not been terribly profitable populations for insurance carriers to pursue all of a sudden be of great value to insurance carriers. And that's the incentive, I believe, that will be the most effective in bringing carriers forward to offer plans on the exchange. We do have active selector abilities in year one to make sure that the products offered are in the interest of consumers. That's something that the Senate felt very important about, was a very important aspect of making sure that the health insurance exchange can function in a way that, you know, again, I think it can work for industry, and it'll also work for consumers, and that's where we've been trying to get. And so in year one, because of the need to get up and running soon, it's a little different than year two, but there is an active selector component in year one. We tease it out in statute a little bit more. What we have, maybe I'll describe year two first and say that in working with the carriers about trying to come up with a framework that might be able to work, and fully acknowledging that they're not in favor of the philosophy behind whether or not we need active selector. They thought that if we were going to have it at all, what could be workable to help narrow the target. You know, I'll say we introduced this bill, and it said that the exchange would have the power to select in the interest of consumers, and that's all it said. And that was very broad and in a way that created a great deal of discomfort. We knew that it would. So we're asking you to produce a product, hit a target, and we haven't really defined what that target is at all. So through the process, we worked and we tried to figure out how we could better define that target. And so in working with the industry, the mechanism that we got to, that again isn't still totally agreed to, but I think is a good mechanism, is rules promulgated by February 1st each year that specify the criteria that the exchange board will use for the selection process and the specific measurements that those criteria will be measured against in order for the evaluation as to whether or not they get into the exchange. That's year two and beyond. Their suggestion was that year one have no rules for access to the exchange, that there's been work with the Department of Health and the Department of Commerce regarding HMO standards, and they thought that'd be just fine. I personally, and the Senate agreed with me, had concerns about the potential of market disruption issues occurring if we didn't have the ability to select in year one. What I'm talking about specifically is if we don't have selection criteria in year one and the ability to make sure that the plans offered are in the interest of consumers, language pulled directly from the Affordable Care Act, and products that are less than what we wish we had on the exchange enter the market, one of the consumer drivers, one of the main consumer drivers, is monthly premium, despite some of the much more value that you get when you increase your premium a little bit. And we could wind up with some plans that really don't cover people's needs if we don't have that selector available in year one. And so not being able to get rules out by February 1st, since we're already past February 1st, well past, we spelled out some of the criteria and framed it as a work in progress. We can talk about what some of those criteria are a little bit, but if they produce plans that aren't what we were really looking for, and those plans are constructed carefully to have narrower networks and ways to drive the premium down, but that don't really have consumers' backs when they get sick, that same plan can also drive significant consumer take-up. And we'll see populations that have a plan that we know isn't really going to work for them if they get sick. And because of the consumer take-up, trying to select them out in a future year causes market disruption issues and is something that's probably going to be untenable for the board. And so year one selection is something that was quite important to the Senate because of those market disruption issues.
Mr. Chairman, what my concern is, which is if I'm a, and I, no offense to the big three carriers, what I really want to make certain that we have is those more modest sized carriers that challenge the big guys, and really, really put them through their paces in terms of providing a competitive product. If I'm one of those, number 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 largest carriers in Minnesota, and I've got to make a decision on whether I'm going to spend. I've heard it's literally in the millions of dollars. I've also heard that about product development, but I heard from Ms. Todd Momlov and the Exchange and other independent folks that they verify that it really is that sizable of an investment on the IT side. Whether the products cost that much to develop or not is more for argument, but the IT investment is significant. And if you're telling me that as of January 1, 2014, I may or may not be in, depending on whether or not I meet your certain criteria, I'm much less likely to invest the millions of dollars into that, in spite of the fact I can capture a market that previously has been unprofitable for me. You understand where we're coming from on the House side? We wanted to guarantee some, at least at the outset, that folks could get certain plans in there.
You know, maybe this is something that actually throughout the entirety of the Senate hearings, I've heard members talk about the millions of dollars that it costs to produce a plan and get it on the market. And in fact, on the Senate floor, it turned into tens of millions of dollars in some way.
And I think it's actually hundreds of millions.
It's billions.
Is it hundreds
billions.
Of millions?
It's billions.
It's billions of dollars to get a plan onto the market. Maybe I would try to entertain a little bit of a, you know, and I've only heard it from members, to tell you the truth. Maybe I could ask somebody from the Department of Commerce, who's helped folks get on the exchange and overseen the books, or somebody from the exchange staff come up and just talk to us a little bit about the true costs of developing a product, getting it to market, the anticipated costs that might be incurred in making the IT investments. I think that would be a worthwhile conversation. You know, the industry I see would like very much to weigh in on this as well.
I'd kind of like to hear from them as well.
I would too. That's fine. I mean, I think.
Mr. Chair.
Who's going to draw the short straw?
Maybe before you've got Representative Liebling.
Oh, Representative Liebling. I'm sorry. We'll
yeah,
go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad you brought that. I was going to ask the same thing, but to that I guess I'd like to add, I just need to understand more what exactly they need to do in terms of IT infrastructure. I think we're skipping over that part, so yeah. If we could add that,
I
it
think
would be
that
helpful.
Would be a very Thank helpful you. Conversation. Thank you. We both came up.
Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, thought it would be helpful to get carrier's perspective on this as well, because I think it would be very different by carrier. So what the carriers will need to do to participate in the exchange is a few different things. I think one of the first things is utilizing a system that they already use today, which is the SERF State Electronic Rate and Form Filing System. And so that system is what's currently used today by the carriers to file their forms and rates. And so that would continue to be used into the future. The exchange will connect to that through our IT system to pull information about the plans that would be shared on the exchange. We will also need to have some direct connections to the carriers for a variety of transactions. One of them is enrollment. And so we'll need to share what's called an 834 enrollment transaction with the carriers. We are going to be utilizing a system that DHS already uses with managed care organizations for Medicaid managed care to transmit that 834. So it's a process that the carrier should be very familiar with already today through how Medicaid enrollment is transferred. Another example of a transaction that we will need to make is what's called an 820. It's a financial transaction, a premium payment transaction that we'll also need to establish with the carriers as well to make that that premium payment for individuals and for small groups. We will also need to do some reconciliation back and forth with the carriers on enrollment. So when people disenroll, for example, or when they stop paying their premium, because we do have a connection with the federal government for the cost-sharing subsidies, and so we'll need to have some reconciliation back and forth with the carriers as well. In terms of what work that would require on the carrier's end, I really think that depends on which carrier you're talking to and what kind of systems they have established, what their current connection is, for example, today to the Department of Human Services in terms of their enrollment transaction, whether or not they're processing premiums today or not, And so that's why I thought it would be helpful to maybe have someone, one of the plans, talk about those transactions.
Ms. Nelson, welcome to the committee again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I think, as you heard, there are a lot of things that we are trying to utilize that we already have in place. For example, the SURF system or the 834, but there are differences. And there are some things that we do have to make sure that we can connect with the state and make sure that those processes happen seamlessly to the consumer. Because we want to make sure that this happens as seamlessly as possible to the consumer. And we're working with the exchange and with the Department of Commerce and with the Department of Human Services to make sure that that all works seamlessly. So that happens to be an awful lot of work. And if anybody has ever worked on an IT project, you will know that it takes several years sometimes to make these transitions. Now, I am not an IT expert, and I will not claim to be. So I don't have the specifics on exactly what our changes are, but they are significant. It's a significant investment for our plan. And I have some dollar amounts that are very approximate, but we are the biggest plan, so we anticipate that there will be quite a few changes that we need to make to make sure that we're up and ready by open enrollment on October 1st, 2013.
I didn't hear a dollar amount from either one of you. I did hear a lot through the testimony.
Billions.
I mean, millions that turned to tens of millions that are, that gained a lot of traction. I'd like to try to find out. So, I mean, it sounds like there is a lot of the IT infrastructure is stuff that already exists and that was seeded. There's some new things, of course, to get up to speed on a new market, but that would be one-time expenses. Is the millions correct? Is the tens of millions correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can tell you that it's approximately between $15 and $25 million for Blue Cross Blue Shield to get our systems up to date so that we can coordinate with the exchange.
For offering all products. Senator Hayden?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, are the dollars related to the interconnectivity to the exchange, or are the dollars more related to the amount of participants that you anticipate you'll gain?
Mr.
Or both?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, it's the interconnectivity to the exchange.
Representative Abler?
Well, maybe
Representative Liebling, then a representative.
I know. I think there's two different kinds of plans here. I think you have maybe the question that we should ask Blue Cross is, if you're going to do the Medicaid thing anyway, they're already going to serve Medicaid people. And so Blue Cross, Medica, Health Partners, and UCare are all going to do Medicaid. So what's that going to cost anyway? Because they're doing that anyway. They're not going to drop out of the Medicaid market. So that's a cost that's a base cost. And now you want to offer a plan in the exchange that's a unique plan. A preferred one has no Medicaid business, so it'll be 100% their cost. And they said $5 million. They didn't say 10. So that's what they said. And Mr. Griffin's not here, I don't see, but he would be a person that has that number. He's told me. So that's just a number. But then if we could ask Blue Cross to tease out what's your plan cost in addition to beyond the Medicaid? That's my question. So can you comment on do you know the difference? And we'll be here tonight if you need to go home and find out. But I think that would be a good question to know the answer to.
Ms. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I do not know the breakdown of that cost, but I can certainly go home to my home in Eagan and find out, see if we can.
You can use my phone. If
okay.
You want. Yeah.
And I can try to tease that out for you and come back tonight with some better numbers.
I've got Representative Liebling and Representative Atkins, but I've actually been getting notes about my comment that we could go to 11:45. Evidently, the sergeant at the sergeant's office at the Senate here really needs to get this room prepped for the noon meeting, and it's a one that is ticketed only. It's a kind of a big deal happening in here.
Was
they're kicking
today?
Us out at 11:30. Sorry about that. So we lose 15 minutes this morning.
Late savings time.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. And I had some of the – thank you, Representative Abler. You said some things I was thinking about, too. But I kind of want to ask Ms. Todd Malmlop, because what I heard, and that was a pretty quick rundown. I tried to take notes. I'm not sure I got it all or got it correctly. But a big chunk of this has to do with the MA enrollment. And as we know, there are only certain carriers that are involved in that. And it seems to me that what might be more disadvantage is the smaller ones, if indeed there is a disadvantage. So I wanted to just ask you kind of, first of all, I mean, can you tell us kind of what's the minimum that a carrier would have to do if they came in new and weren't doing the MA side and just are going to sell plans on the exchange? What's the minimum they could get away with? Now, I know you can't perhaps cost that out, but just in terms of infrastructure, what is just going to be the bare bones requirement that they have to do in order to be prepared to sell on the exchange?
Ms. Malma.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, there are a few key functions that they'd have to perform. How that impacts their system, I think that does depend on the carrier and kind of what type of infrastructure they already have and if they need to upgrade that. So I can't comment on that specifically, but in terms of the key functions, and these are things that they would need to do, also need just to interact with the federal hub as well. And so all carriers would need to do this is one, they need to be able to process 834s. And so that's the enrollment transaction. That is the transaction that is very similar today to what Medicaid does with the health plans. And so someone that's not working with Medicaid, they need to be able to transmit that 834 information. They also need to be able to accept premium payments through an 820 transaction, especially for the small group where that is required under the ACA that occur. On the individual side, that is not a required functionality because an individual can pay the carrier directly, but on small group, it would be required. And then there are the transactions to reconcile essentially the tax credits and the cost-sharing reductions. And then reconciliation actually is between the exchange and the federal hub and the carrier. And so that would need to also occur. Those three key functions are the essential functions that the carriers would need to be able to do.
Representative Liebling, a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Todd Malmoff. And do you have any sense of, I know you can't put a dollar figure on it, but do you have any sense of how big a deal it is to do those things? I mean, I just, as a layperson on the technology side, I just don't, you know, I know that my mid-20s son can sit down at a computer and do a lot. And on the other hand, I know that the exchange itself is a very big IT undertaking. So where would you place this on the scale of how complex this would be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, it's hard for me to share that. I mean, I think that's actually a question you need to ask all the different carriers because all of them have different infrastructures and that they're building from, some of them older and some of them much newer than others. And so depending on where they are in the upgrade of that system, it could be not very much at all or could be quite a bit depending on what they're upgrading from. So it's really hard for me to express that. I would actually, you know, I would ask Blue Cross and Medica and Health Partners preferred one another's kind of where they're starting from. It's really hard for me to be able to quantify that.
Representative Atkins.
And, Mr. Chair, I'll pass. Those were exactly the questions that I was going to follow up on.
Well, maybe I'll start. Oh, Abler. Representative Abler.
Well, and just I had something else on the same topic. The complexity, I mean, whenever I use this word with some of the older department people at DHS, they cringe. But, you know, this health match thing. I mean, we tried, and it was really complicated. And it wasn't as simple as we thought. And we always were done, oh, that puts off health match 7 months. That cost you $6 million. And I have my kid help me figure out my computer sometimes. He's 14 now, and so it works. So I'm no technology guy, as Dr. Golden could tell you. But I have a question on this. This is really fascinating to me. This is, like, so interesting and, you know, high stakes and all. But maybe somebody can explain for me on the year one, if you did active selector in year one, what does that look like? I'm understood that there's some deadlines about you have to get rates and submit things. And just even the practicality, let's say you liked it, and, you know, I'm troubled by some of the impacts of that. And maybe there's some way to work it into my troubled mind yet. But can maybe the two of you could comment on the timetable. So let's say, you know, the bill passes and it gets signed March 31st, and then you get a board appointed. The governor has a bit of time, and there's a process to ratify. And when they actually even get working, much less set up their rules and their infrastructure and who's the chair and all that, what's the quickest you could actually get selection criteria in place? And does that even work for this year to help the plan submit a product on time and get it even to hook up? That's my question.
Well, Representative Abler, if you look at the side-by-side, the R15, that's why in year one we didn't ask them to promulgate rules about what the criteria would be for the interest in the interest of consumer, which is the operative language for how the exchange could select or not select to offer a plan. And at the bottom on the Senate side on the R15 is what the in the interest of consumer means. It's by considering a combination of the following criteria. There are six of them listed: reasonableness of expected costs, supporting the premium cost sharing, quality and sufficiency of the plan's networks, quality improvement activities, quality initiatives related to cultural and linguistic competency, promotion of initiatives for improving health, disease prevention, and wellness, and sixth, providing a manageable number of choices to consumers that present clear product differentiation. So this was, again, presented as a work in progress. It hasn't, I haven't gotten a lot of comments about how to change that or improve it or, make it better. We can have a conversation about that. But I actually would, we've had a pretty good conversation about active purchaser, I think, and kind of have a decent idea. We've covered the funding. We heard a little bit from MCHA. I'd like to move to rulemaking for our last few minutes this morning, if members would work with me here, and just ask about the House's rulemaking that's 30 days, kind of bypassing a lot of Chapter 14 that is pretty important procedural due process for folks interacting with a public function. So maybe I could,
Mr. Chair,
ask a little bit about the House rulemaking and get you to explain that a little bit.
Just, Mr. Chair, before you go to that, and I'm comfortable, but I think the question of logistics is the one we should talk about then tonight, because I think it's a real question and it's a work in progress. I'm trying to help the progress. And so, maybe they can even get a kind of a defined logistical thing, and I'll yield on the rulemaking topic. I know we're short of time, so I'll yield and thank you.
Representative Atkins.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually might turn to Mr. Shepard to provide a more accurate description, and then I'd like to provide the
Representative Atkins,
policy
I answered
reason.
All your questions.
And I could answer this one, too, but probably not as well as you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, the House's rulemaking proposal would state that if the board's policies and procedures constitute rules under Chapter 14, then they would publish notice in the State Register. Interested parties would have 30 days to comment on the proposed rules, and the board would be required to consider the comments it receives. And then after the board considers the comments, it would publish the final rule in the State Register. There's some fairly technical provisions about what happens if the adopted rules are the same as the proposed rules. Then the board would just publish a notice of adoption. If the adopted rules differ from the rules originally proposed, the notice would show what had changed. And then as far as timing of when things take effect, the House provides that if the rules are published in the State Register before January 1st, 2014, they would take effect immediately upon publication in the State Register. If they are published on and after January 1, 2014, they would take effect 30 days after publication in the State Register.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I learned as a baby lawyer many years ago that when you have the most credible, respected witness in the room, you let him talk. So it's nice to have, and I assume he's well-regarded by members of both
Absolutely.
The House and the Senate.
Absolutely.
The purpose behind that was obviously in the outset in particular, we've got to get things up and running relatively. All of this, everything that Mr. Shepard just described, all of the testimony, all of this is open and public and above board and transparent and comments. And the issue that we run into, and now I'm going to talk about Senate language a little bit, is just all of the added time that goes into it. I am not one that wants to avoid due process or anything along those lines, but with just there's so many things that got to get up and running relatively quick that if we can come up with a process that still has all of the sunshine and openness and input and manage to carry out what needs to be done, getting rules out, for example, to these navigators, the entities that are going to be literally on the front lines explaining to people what the process is that they're going through, if it has to go through the whole ALJ process and be approved by the governor and all of those pieces that are implied in that, you're literally talking months, Mr. Chairman. And that, I don't want consumers to be waiting, you know, if they're waiting for information from the navigators or they're waiting for information from the folks that are in the call centers and have to be, well, we're waiting for that rule to get approved. It'll be another 4.5 to 5 months, and then we'll let you know. That is not what we're, particularly in an entrepreneurial kind of venture like this, I don't think anybody's benefited by that, so long as we still protect with the protections that have been outlined in our rule. Sunshine.
Just for clarification on the Senate language, we actually do have a similar, you know, I don't know what you want to call it, very expedited process that is kind of in sync with yours. We're 21 days instead of 30 days, actually. And we run that for the first, call it 9 months, up until January 1, 2014. The exchange, MMB initially, and the exchange board, once they're up and running, have that ability to get the initial policies and procedures up and get to a little bit more stable position. But in the Senate, we felt a little bit more comfortable falling back on a bit more of a known process with the expedited rulemaking as provided for in Chapter 14. And that is a, you know, a six-month rulemaking process. Standard rulemaking takes about 24 months, 2 years. And we did feel that was – we understood the need for nimbleness and responsiveness to be able to work in a changing – economic environment, and so the 6 months was very important, but the, you know, keeping the incredibly expedited for the entire operation of the board is something that we got rid of basically, I think, at the very first committee stop that we had because of due process concerns, notice, opportunity to be heard, meaningful public input. And I see a lot of that there, enough to that we're comfortable getting the board up and running with the more expedited process and having reports about the rules that were adopted come back to the legislature to take a look at and make sure that we're fully engaged and understand how this the board is operating, but a little bit of nerves about the level of sunshine, as you described it. Representative Abler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's kind of nice to have stumbled on an area that there's bipartisan interest on this area. And I think that Representative Atkins illustrated very well the need for year one's different than year two, and I think everybody recognizes that. And I, for one, like the protection of a bit of a process, and I know there was a lot of talk about that from many members, and I'm not a GovOps guy, and like Representative Atkins, on this topic, I let experts talk about it. But I think just philosophically, I think this is something we're going to come to a good conclusion on that it'll be reasonable. But I think that the sunshine is important to people, especially something with this big. And right now there's no legislative oversight. This is the only oversight this board gets. They write a rule, then people get to talk about it. And with, you know, the auditor or whatever, a few reports being cast about. So.
Did you see the softball he just threw you?
I know. I mean, I can't help myself. There is legislative oversight on the Senate bill. We have a legislative oversight committee.
Whose team are you on, Abler?
I know, right?
Oh.
Well,
Mr. Chair, but it's this comment. They don't get to run anything. They don't approve the budget. And they don't get to actually – they oversee it by seeing. They don't.
This small group of legislators does not have the ability
they don't have a button
to actually
they can push
intervene.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, you do run into, you know, separation of powers issues. Empowering a small group of legislators to actually functionally intervene in the operations of the exchange is something that I was quite uncomfortable with. But making sure that they're well-informed and coming back to the legislature, and I have full faith that this exchange board will listen carefully to what this group says. They're going to be tasked with having open public hearings and giving their input about the direction it should go. And if the board goes rogue, we're going to come back and you know, put the proper checks on how they're behaving. So,
Pedro,
Representative Liebling.
Well, right, Mr. Chair, and you know, as a practical matter, the legislature really always has oversight because, right, the legislature giveth and the legislature taketh away.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Good work.
And I'd love Senator Metz to want to say something, but I would actually, that's not always possible. We have to pass a bill.
Oh, good.
If you divide a government, you might not pass a bill about how to control this. Look at the Met Council, how that's been so controversial. All my 14 years, we've talked about changes we might make. No changes. At the end of the day, and great angst on both sides of the aisle about somehow that's how it goes. So I'll yield. Thanks. Senator Metzen wanted to say something.
Get that figured out.
Senator Metzen, did you have?
No, I'm just, no, no.
Okay.
Abler wants me to say something, but I'm not going to.
Oh, I thought you were, I thought you had your hand raised up there. I just like hearing the talk. It's good.
Other comments of members. I mean, I think we got a taste of each of the issues we were hoping to cover this morning. Out of respect for the wonderful work done by the Senate Sergeant-at-Arms, I'm going to give them an extra 2 minutes to prep the room, and we will recess at the call of the chair. Again, hope to come back no later than 7:30. You cannot leave your stuff. You need to take your materials, not stuff. It's technical. We are recess at the call of the chair.